Hello, and welcome to another episode of Max Planck Florida's Neurotransmissions Podcast. I'm Joe Schumacher, and I'm joined today by Jeremy Chang. Jeremy, how you doing?
Pretty good, Joe.
And today we roped in our old friend, Audrey Bonal. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi.
You're our resident cerebellum expert here at the podcast, and we need your help today because we're talking to a cerebellar guru, and maybe you can sort of bring us up to speed. What are sort of the textbook fundamental aspects of cerebellum neuroscience that the lay listener would want to know about getting started?
Where should we start looking for the cerebellum?
Well, thank you for inviting me. And you should start by knowing that the cerebellum is just an amazing brain structure. No, I'm joking.
The cerebellum is amazing.
Yeah. And it's mainly studied for its role in motor function and motor learning. The reason why the cerebellum is a great model to study motor learning is because of its relatively simple circuitry. And so we can really look at the circuits and at changes in the circuit and see how they relate with changes in behavior. So that's really what I'm interested in doing, for example. And
Who are the major players in that circuit that you're talking about?
So that's where I was going to go. Inputs arrive to the cerebellum, right, carrying motor and sensory informations, and they all eventually converge onto the Purkinje cells, which are the sole output of the cerebellum. So when you will hear about Purkinje cell later in this podcast, you can think about it as like, yes, what's the output of the cerebellum to other brain structures. And one thing you want to know also about these Purkinje cells is that they are inhibitory. So when you activate them, you're actually inhibiting downstream targets.
Great. And okay, so now sort of switching gears to from this black box textbook version of the cerebellum, our guest today studies the link between cerebellum and social behavioral deficits such as autism spectrum disorder.
Exactly.
You, as a cerebellum expert, are you surprised to hear that there's such a strong link between specific types of cerebellar problems and autism?
Well, not so surprised anymore because actually since a few years now, it has emerged that the cerebellum does not only play a role in motor function, but is also involved with many cognitive functions, and that actually dysfunctions of the cerebellum are linked with many brain disorders, including epilepsy, schizophrenia, and as we'll talk about today, autism spectrum disorders.
So today we'll be talking to Dr. Peter Tsai from UT Southwestern Medical Center. We're going to cover a lot of ground, not just in terms of how you study the link between the cerebellum and autism, but some of the methodological aspects of this research. Jeremy, what are some of the highlights and some of the background that people might want to have before going into this?
Well, so one of the unique things about our guest today is that Dr. Tsai has an MD PhD. So not only is he actively performing research at the bench using animal models, but he also treats patients. And that sort of has played an essential role in the path that he's taken through his research.
And he is doing research in both mice and humans. So really you can see like how findings in mice models can correlate with what happens in humans.
Yeah, because I think one of the major things that people have seen in preclinical studies oftentimes is that things that happen to work out in a mouse don't always happen to work out in a human. But really pay attention to the ways that Dr. Tsai and his colleagues try to find these really strong relationships between structural and functional commonalities between these very different species. I'm not 100% sure, but this might be the first time we talk about dreads on the podcast. This is what you'll hear about, this chemogenetic approach where you can express specific receptors to, cause specific processes that you want to happen in specific parts of the brain. So that's a very interesting methodological approach for understanding neural circuits and their behavioral functions.
Very powerful tool to manipulate cellular activity in a controlled way.
So what else? Are we good? Ready to go?
I think we're good.
Cool.
Why don't we jump right in?
All right. So here's our interview with Dr. Tsai.
Enjoy.
So today we are joined by Professor Peter Tsai from UT Southwestern Medical Center. He's an assistant professor in the departments of neurology and neurotherapeutics, neuroscience, pediatrics, and psychiatry. Dr. Tsai, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So one of the really interesting things about your career is while you're an MD PhD student, trying to sort of figure out where's the link between clinical, you know, work and, you know, bench neuroscience, you decided to go pretty much all in on cerebellum. So what was it that drew you to cerebellum to begin with?
You know, so if you actually asked me during my graduate career that I, you know, would you be studying the cerebellum, I would say absolutely not. This would be kind of really far afield what, from what I thought I would be studying. And so, you know, life takes its own twists and turns, if you will. And so when I started my child neurology residency, I, you know, was interested in a lot of things, not sure exactly what I was going to do. And I ran into a number of kids, which kind of threw me down this path, if you will, right? So run into a number of kids who had, you know, really specific kind of abnormalities of the cerebellum. And I had this expectation from everything that I've been taught from undergrad to grad school to residency. Everyone, you know, everything I learned about the cerebellum was that is important for motor coordination, is important for motor learning. And pretty much that's all it is. I mean, one other thing, I guess, so one of the lions in the field, I guess, that I learned from kind of during residency, you know, he was examining one of these MRI scans and he was like, look at the cerebellum. It's so beautiful. Like, unfortunately, all it is a pillow for the visual cortex. You know, it's too bad it's not something more, right? And so I had, again, this expectation that really all it is doing, you know, not all it's doing, but, you know, its primary, its function, right, is for motor coordination, right? That was my expectation, right? So there were these kids that kind of were coming into clinic with isolated cerebellar abnormalities. And so, again, when I was preparing for clinic, you know, I'm expecting these kids are going to come in, I'm going to deal with motor abnormalities, send them to the various physical therapies that they need. And that's kind of, you know, kind of where this was at. And so these kids would come in and, you know, I would often start, you know, kind of the interaction with the parents and asking kind of what are the things that you really are concerned about? And to basically a one, every single one of these parents, you know, 1 through 10, nothing had to do with motor function, all, you know, related to, you know, my kid doesn't seem to be socializing so well. His language is impacted. His processing seems to be difficult for him, you know, and kind of all of these things that really made you think actually on cognitive behavioral kind of levels, right? And in particular, many of these kids had all of the behavioral hallmarks that, you know, you would think, wow, this kid really looks like they have kind of an autism spectrum disorder, social impairments, repetitive behaviors, stereotypic behaviors, kind of these whole nine yards. And all of that was very unanticipated, I think would be a very generous way of saying it. This really was a big surprise to me. And so, you know, it happens once and you say, hey, you know, maybe this is just one aberration, it's anecdotal, whatever. And it happens twice, three times, whatever. And then you realize maybe this is something that's not just a, you know, kind of a one-off, if you will. And so as I started to take a look at this, this seemed really kind of fascinating because, again, it violated all of the dogma that I had learned. And so that kind of took me down this rabbit hole that is now the career that I'm following.
So you're expecting a lot of motor abnormalities. You see a lot of sort of cognitive affective disorder. Does this make you sort of go back to the literature and did you find anything that says, well, hey, there actually is maybe some basis for a non-motor cerebellum?
Yeah, so that's a great question, actually. And what surprised me was how much literature there was, right? Despite the fact that I was taught, you know, again, everything I learned was motor, is actually there was a huge amount of literature that pointed to the cerebellum doing more than that. And to address autism in specific, right, actually the most, you know, consistently identified pathology in autism spectrum disorders, if you look at postmortem studies, is actually cerebellar, right? And so this was kind of the first thing that I ran into and I was like, wow, that's really surprising. I had not heard about this at all, right? And then when you look kind of deeper into it, so for autism, you know, you think about imaging studies, you think about functional kind of imaging studies, all of these studies kind of really support a very strong role for the cerebellum or implicate a strong role for the cerebellum in these disorders. If you look at kind of the flip side of individuals who have cerebellar dysfunction because of cerebellar developmental abnormalities, you know, things like Joubert's, things about like rhomboencephalosynapses, cerebellar hypoplasia, et cetera, all of these individuals have actually really high rates of autism. And so all of these kinds of things, again, lots of literature, but somehow it never crossed my path. So I was actually really surprised by kind of, yeah, I mean, how many studies there were.
So this is super interesting, but this is also just correlations, right? Like cerebellum and autism. So how do you actually study the function of the cerebellum or the role of the cerebellum in autism in a more controlled way? Or like, how do you...
It's probably difficult to do circuit work and looking
in a human...
In a human, right?
So, like, and it also, I think you slipped that in there. It's, a lot of this seems to be developmental in origin as well, right? A lot of your patients you were seeing were kids. Mm-hmm. This sort of manifests early in development.
So this is a great question. So if you look at the literature, actually, so if cerebellar dysfunction happens in adult populations, so work by you know, Jeremy Schmalman and his colleagues at the Mass General, you don't see autism. What they have described actually is social. There are social impairments, but it's not autism to the level of the disorder that, you know, kind of is classically defined as an autism spectrum disorder. So it looks like there is a developmental component to kind of what is going on. But I think, to Audrey, to your question, right, is this, you know, how do you get beyond these kind of correlations that, hey, there seems to be some sort of cerebellar abnormality and you see autism, but are the two related? And, you know, this was... essentially, you know, kind of when I started asking about these to, you know, to my mentors and to kind of the folks who trained me, right? This is essentially kind of the question that I was constantly kind of met with, right? Is that, you know, hey, it can't be. The cerebellum is really important for motor coordination. How is it possible? Like all of this literature that's out there, yes, it's there, but it must be secondary to something else. You're missing what is truly relevant here. And so we wanted to ask this question. And obviously, kind of as you guys were mentioning, you can't really do this for good ethical reasons in humans. And so we went to answer this kind of question. We went to a more kind of preclinical, quote unquote, you know, animal model. So we looked at the mouse because of the loss of available tools and the genetic tractability, if you will, to answer these questions. So because the mouse gives you and affords you the opportunity to target specific cell types, to target specific regions, both on the genetic level and kind of on the functional circuit level, we thought that this was a great model system to go after this kind of question.
And they have social behaviors.
Yeah. And so, again, importantly, you know, thanks for reminding me. I think, you know, importantly, there's also a readout that is relevant to, you know, the behaviors that you would, you know, associate with autism. So autism as defined, right, is some sort of social impairment with repetitive behaviors, restrictive interest, kind of, you know, perseveration, cognitive stickiness, you know, if you will. And you can model many of these behaviors, at least to some extent, in the mouse. You know, mice are social. You can look at these social behaviors. They can have behaviors that can become repetitive. And you can look at specific tests of flexibility to get at some of these kinds of questions. Now, I don't pretend to say that these are quote unquote autistic mice. All we can say really is that these mice show autism relevant behaviors. I think that's important to point out. But kind of as best as, you know, we can look at some of these behaviors, the mouse presents a interesting model system to interrogate these aspects.
It's sort of built into the name for autism, this autism spectrum disorder, that there's sort of this range of behaviors. What are the sorts of behaviors that you're looking to reproduce within your model organism?
Yeah. So, you know, kind of classically, the two defining characteristics of an autism spectrum disorder is social dysfunction and some sort of repetitive behavior / restrictive interest. And so we can look at social behaviors in a number of different ways in the mouse, from social approach assays to social novelty assays. You can look at how animals kind of interact in freely moving environments. you can ascertain kind of how using olfactory cues that animals kind of socialize, kind of from repetitive behaviors. Again, there's a lot of different behaviors that an animal will do that can become repetitive and has been shown in a number of models of autism-linked genes. In addition, you can look up behavioral flexibility, you know, in classic models that like the Morris water maze. You can look at reversal learning paradigms there. You can look at it in, you know, things that are a little bit more, that are more simpler, if you will. Things like the T maze or Y maze task, spontaneous alternations, these kinds of things that can give you inroads into the flexibility or the cognitive flexibility of the animal.
So what is the mouse model you're using for your studies?
So we have used, so initially when we wanted to ask this question, you know, we thought we would take a genetic approach. And as our kind of genetic model system, we chose a model, a mouse model of tuberous sclerosis. So tuberous sclerosis is a neurodevelopmental disorder that is associated with high rates of autism, so about 50%. We thought this model might also be particularly interesting because if you go and you take all comers with TSC or tuberous sclerosis, these individuals who have autism have also evidence of cerebellar lesions. They also have evidence of cerebellar dysfunction, which those with TSC without autism do not have. And so we thought, hey, this already in this particular neurodevelopmental disorder, the cerebellum is implicated. And so we thought this might be a good model system. And so what we did was we generated a mouse model whereby one of the genes responsible for the disorder, TSC1, was specifically knocked out in cerebellar Purkinje cells. And so it allowed us to ask this question. So a specific deletion of this gene just in cerebellar Purkinje cells, was this sufficient, you know, if you will, was, you know, one, can we cause any cerebellar dysfunction? Does it impact the cerebellum in any way? And if we can, is this sufficient to generate, you know, some of the behaviors that we would kind of associate with autism? And what we found was that these animals display the kind of classic pathology that you associate with autism. So Purkinje cell loss. These animals also showed evidence of cerebellar dysfunction, decreased spontaneous firing rates, as well as decreased excitability. Again, that is consistent with some of the imaging studies that showed decreased cerebellar output in individuals with autism. And then when we actually assayed their behavior, what we also noticed was that these mice showed decreased social interaction. They showed repetitive behaviors. They also showed behavioral inflexibility, as well as abnormal ultrasonic vocalizations. So all of the kind of the hallmarks that you might associate with an autism spectrum disorder. So it looked like that cerebellar dysfunction in and of itself was sufficient to generate these autism relevant behaviors.
Wow. So now, how would you answer people that say that actually you can live without a cerebellum and nothing happens to you? You're perfectly normal.
Yeah. So this, you know, fascinating question, right? And so I think, you know, kind of Audrey, what you're alluding to, right, is that there are individuals who have been, you know, described who are born without any evidence of a cerebellum. So they image them, you take an MRI, they don't have a cerebellum at all, but they're walking around out there, you know, having jobs, et cetera, not having autism. And so how is it, if you can exist without it, how could the cerebellum be actually associated with autism, right? But what's interesting about these individuals is at least some of the descriptions of these individuals show that they can move around with no problem. There are no signs of developmental delays in these individuals. They work on motor-based tasks and they're totally fine. And yet we know very clearly from all of the kind of work across past centuries and the one before, right, that the cerebellum clearly has roles in motor coordination and motor learning. And yet these individuals without the cerebellum also have no evidence of of motor or no significant motor abnormalities, right? And so yet, you know, I think very clearly we would all say, hey, the cerebellum, we know the cerebellum has a role in this. And so when I think what it speaks to is not so much that the cerebellum can't have a role in motor or they can't have a role in these autism-related behaviors, but actually it says something about the plasticity and the amazing plasticity in my mind of what the brain can do. So if you're born without it, the brain finds a way, if you will, to, you know, take over those important roles that the cerebellum had and finds a way to have, you know, motor functions, to have behaviors that, you know, social behaviors, et cetera, that you would normally associate with autism.
So I think one thing we haven't talked about yet is that, I mean, the cerebellum, just like So cerebellum means little brain, right? So like the big brain, you know, has lots of, you know, subdivisions and specifically anatomical and functional segregation. As far as I know, I don't study it, but so how do you pinpoint a specific part of cerebellum to study? I mean, a lot of your recent work is along the lines of, you know, specific cerebellar cortical circuits that are involved in some of these social behaviors. How do you know where to go? And then once you get there, what are some of the manipulations you can do?
Yeah, so this is a great question. The little brain, if you will, I think is actually probably a really good, you know, whoever back in the good old days when whoever defined the cerebellum actually, I think, got it right, because it looks like the cerebellum actually is acting as a little brain, that in fact, if you look at, you know, kind of all of the studies looking at anatomical connections between the cerebellum and the quote unquote big brain, you realize that the cerebellum actually seems to have connections pretty much everywhere across this big brain, right? And so it looks like, right, so is there representation just like in the big brain for visual function, auditory function, motor function, sensory function, et cetera? Is there also a specific representation within the cerebellum itself? And at least for motor function, it looks like there are specific regions of the cerebellum that seem to be implicated. But even for these non-motor functions, so if you look at functional imaging studies, it actually looks like for specific tasks, there are specific regions of the cerebellum that seem to be activated or kind of functional during those specific tasks. And so we wanted to ask this question that you're alluding to, right, are there specific regions that are actually important for these kind of autism-relevant behaviors, if you will. And so one of the ways we've done this is going back to the literature and seeing what parts of the cerebellum are actually implicated in studies of clinical autism. And so that's one aspect. The other way that we kind of wanted to approach it is, well, what happens if we take kind of in some ways an unbiased look at this and just say, okay, if we image using MRI techniques, and this is with a wonderful collaboration with Jason Lurch's group now at the University of Oxford, can we do this in kind of agnostically, right? Can we say we don't know where these abnormalities are, but if we take our cerebellar mutants that have these autism-relevant behaviors, if we image them, do we find any areas that are changed that might suggest a specific area of the cerebellum that might be at play for these behaviors? And so that's what we did. Again, took this MRI-based approach, and what we identified were that there were, in fact, specific areas that were structurally altered in our cerebellar TSC mutants. And one of these areas that kind of jumped out at us was this area CRUS1. And the region that it popped out was actually, if you go and you do the exact same study in individuals with autism, this is one of the regions that most consistently pops out as well as having its volume altered. And what's interesting about it is that the degree of alteration of this volume, of the structure, if you will, is actually correlated with the severity of the social phenotypes that they have, again, in individuals with autism.
So the alteration here is it smaller or is it more active, less active?
So this is all based on structure. So okay. So when I'm talking about structure, so decreased size of this particular structure. It's interesting, actually, when you raise this point, is actually depending on where you are in the cerebellum, you can actually get increased and or decreased size depending on where you are. And actually that seems to be holding true kind of in more recent studies of mouse imaging of the cerebellum in kind of autism models as well.
So just to reiterate what you were telling us, in individual with severe autism, you have this region, particular region of the cerebellum that shows dysfunction. And now when you're taking your mouse model where this protein is mutated everywhere in the cerebellum, this same specific region is also altered. So, what happens if you try to manipulate this region now?
Yeah, so again, kind of back to the correlation question, right? So this is still kind of in its nature correlative, right? So you see an abnormality in this area CRUS1, but can we answer, is this region really truly relevant for these behaviors? And so to get at this question, we took a chemogenetic approach. And so combining with genetic models, we were able to target kind of the function of Purkinje cells specifically within this region of CRUS1 and specifically on the right side. That if we target this region and cause basically inhibit function within the Purkinje cells in this region, we can generate, we can cause the mouse, again, their baseline is to be, is a control animal, so they're social, but when we inhibit these Purkinje cell activity, we can actually cause social impairments within this animal. In addition, when you inhibit this, these regions, these animals also demonstrate repetitive behaviors as well as behavioral inflexibility, if you will, across some of the models that that we looked at. And the reason that we think kind of decreasing activity was the way to go and to answer this question is if you look at our Purkinje cell models, they show evidence of decreased activity as well as decreased excitability. And we also, if you look at clinical evidence, there's clinical evidence as well of decreased cerebellar output. So we thought that this was the way to go. And that's what it seemed, that decreasing activity seemed to drive these abnormal behaviors.
So you've identified a region and then you use chemogenetics. Could you tell us a little bit more about what chemogenetics are and how you're using them to alter cerebellar activity?
Yeah, so chemogenetics is, is a paradigm that was kind of developed by Brian Roth's group at the University of North Carolina. And what it is essentially in this particular case, for lack of better words, so they define it as a designer receptor exclusively activated by a designer drug, or a DRED, if you will, as an abbreviation. And what this is essentially a receptor that's been modified such that cause... basically, it changes within the cell to either activate a cell or to inhibit a cell. And so in their particular case, is this is a muscarinic receptor, so an acetylcholine receptor that's been specifically modified so that it does not bind acetylcholine anymore. And it now only binds an inert compound called clozapine N oxide, or CNO. And what this nice about this receptor is that this is a G-protein coupled receptor. And so you can couple it with whatever G-protein of your interest such that it can either inhibit or activate a cell depending on, whether the ligand is present or not. And so what this allows you to do is we can then put this receptor into, in this case, Purkinje cells, specifically into Purkinje cells of Rietkreuz-1. And, when you just wash on vehicle, so again, no compound to activate the receptor, the animal should just be like, whatever animal that you're putting it in this case, a control animal. So it should act and have normal social behaviors just like any other control animal. And what allows you to do, what's nice about this even more so, is then you can take this exact same animals and now inject CNO into these animals and activate the receptor and see what happens as a result of this. So again, each animal provides its own internal control. And so what we did in this particular paradigm is we took a receptor that initiates a G-protein coupled cascade that will inhibit cellular activity. And so when we wash on CNO, it's inhibiting Purkinje cell activity. And then you can ask the question is, what does that inhibition result in? And specifically in terms of relation to autism-like behaviors.
And this is, I think we've definitely talked about optogenetics before on the podcast. What are the sort of differences in the techniques?
Yeah, so there are many. So they're similar in ways that this is a way to functionally kind of interrogate circuits, if you will, right? And so optogenetics, and again, this is paradigms, kind of Dinesh Roth's group, et cetera, allows you a lot of temporal precision that the chemogenetics don't perhaps allow you to do. Chemogenetics actually allows you perhaps a greater scope in time. So, takes when you inject in vivo, then it takes about half an hour, but then it lasts for a number of hours, right? So where you are altering excitability within the cells. Whereas sometimes in, optogenetics, again, it's depending on where you're driving activity, it tends to be more temporal in nature and more kind of for short term kind of behavioral paradigms, if you will. One of the other things is I think, for chemogenetics, you alter excitability as opposed to altering channel properties that are driving activity. And so by that alteration of excitability, it does allow in some ways the kind of
underlying activity
to be altered, but still to go on in a way that, when you're driving activity up or down with optogenetics, it doesn't necessarily afford you those opportunities.
Now you really nicely described how by inhibiting a specific region of the cerebellum using this chemogenetics, you could induce autistic-like behavior in a mouse and that's really exciting. But could we use a similar strategy to relieve some of the symptoms in an autistic mouse? Or could we even think in the future about targeting this region to sort of treat autism-like disorders?
Yeah, so this is a great question, right? And so, you know, we were thinking about kind of these questions. And, you know, what we noticed was that, again, in our mutant animals, you see decreased excitability, decreased kind of activity. We see in individuals with autism kind of decreased cerebellar output. And what we were showing here with the chemogenetics is that decreasing activity was driving, it was sufficient to generate kind of these abnormal behaviors, right? And so we kind of relatively simplistically asked, well, what happens if down is bad? You know, can we actually kind of turn the paradigm on its head and up the gain, if you will, and increase activity within these Purkinje cells, within this kind of cerebellar mutant model, and ask, would that actually improve behaviors to get at whether there's a possibility, you know, that neuromodulation of the cerebellum might actually maybe have a translational benefit, right? And so we looked in our mouse mutant model, you know, so stimulating Purkinje cell activity within just this region, right, CRUS1, and lo and behold, what we found was that it actually improved social behaviors in these mutant animals using a number of different paradigms. But what was also interesting is what we found was we could not improve the repetitive behaviors, and we could not improve the inflexible behavior, the behavioral inflexibility. So it was really only kind of, it seemed specific to the social behaviors where we saw changes. And, you know, and then I think to your question, so that's interesting, but again, at the end of the day, this is a mouse, and right, I think the literature and the road, if you will, is littered with many situations where we have done a great job improving mouse behavior, but that these things unfortunately have not translated well to individuals with, you know, whatever disease, you know, autism, etc., right? And so we wanted to ask, right, is there a possibility, is there ways to think about that this actually may have some parallels in individuals or humans, you know, with autism, right? And so we had demonstrated, or so we first went back and we looked at our mutant animals and we said, you know, we know kind of traditionally, if you think about how the cerebellum works, the cerebellum seems to work by communicating with cerebral cortical, so the big brain, if you will, and cerebral cortical circuits. And so we wanted to ask, are there regions of the cerebral cortex, you know, the big brain, if you will, that the cerebellum is talking to that are relevant to these, you know, these particular behaviors, right? And so what we went is we took a look at our mutants, and again, taking an MRI-based approach, we went and we looked at connectivity between the cerebellum and the cerebral cortex. And we said, in our mutant animals, are there kind of right CRUS1 to cerebral cortical circuits that are abnormal or disrupted in these mutant animals? And we found a number, but one of the circuits places of disconnection that really popped out at us was this connection to a part of the brain called the parietal association cortex. And the reason that this region kind of jumped out at us was this is a region that is analogous in humans to the inferior parietal lobule. And the inferior parietal lobule is a region that has been implicated in many, many studies to be associated with autism. And we thought, that's interesting, right? And so we then asked, okay, well, if this is something that we see in our mouse model, is this something that might have any relevance to humans, right? Do you see a similar disruption in individuals with autism? And so with a collaboration with Stuart Mostofsky's group at Johns Hopkins, where he had imaged a large cohort of children with autism compared to a large cohort of individuals, as controls. What he found was a similar disruption in connectivity between CRUS1 and the inferior parietal lobule, the kind of that we see in mice, he also saw in the kids with autism spectrum disorder. What we then also wanted to ask as well, okay, so we see disruptions within this, but are these regions actually functionally in any way connected, right? And so if this is true, we would expect that if we manipulate cerebellar activity in CRUS1, we would expect then to see changes in activity within parietal association cortex if there is a functional connection. And so what we did was we again took a chemogenic approach, decreased activity within cerebellar Purkinje cells, and we put a recording electrode in the contralateral parietal association cortex and asked, did we see anything different? In effect, we did. So when you decrease cerebellar Purkinje cell activity in right crease 1, you now see an increased activity within the parietal association cortex. And then the vice versa is also true. If you activate Purkinje cell activity in right crease 1, you now see a decreased activity within the parietal association cortex. And so we then wanted to ask, well, if we see this in mice, if this is truly a relevant circuit in humans, what would happen if you modulated right crease 1 in humans? And so with a great, wonderful collaborator at American University, Catherine Studley, what she was doing is using a non-invasive neuromodulation technique called transcranial direct current stimulation, or TDCS. And so if you put TDCS over this right crease 1 area and you activate it using anodal stimulation, so it should be stimulating Purkinje cells, what happens to the rest of the brain? And so, you know, we like to do things in kind of blinded fashion. And so we said, okay, we're going to be agnostic about it. We won't tell you what we see. And we'll ask you, what do you end up seeing? So when you modulate right crease 1, do you see changes in connectivity with any other parts of the brain? And if so, kind of what are they, and do they actually match at all what we see in the mice? And what was interesting is, so when she did this and she looked at the cross again, the entire brain, kind of do a whole brain analysis on this, the region that most significantly popped up in terms of altered connections was the actual contralateral inferior parietal lobule. Again, this analogous regions in humans to what we see in the mouse. And so what we see now, right, is parallels of right crease 1 to be implicated in both our mouse model in terms of from on the structural level, to be abnormal in our mouse model, that has autism-relevant behaviors, our TSC model, as well as individuals with autism. We see that there are abnormal connections between this region and the parietal association cortex in our model, as well as individuals with autism. And we see that modulation of this region alters activity within the parietal association cortex in mice, as well as a parallel in humans. And we know that this manipulation is sufficient to improve behaviors, as social behaviors at least, in our mouse model of autism. And so it begs the question to some degree, is there a therapeutic opportunity here? Is there an opportunity whereby, you know, stimulation of this region in humans might have some potential benefit for individuals with autism and specifically for social behaviors? And so these are the questions that we would love to pursue.
Yeah. What are the current treatment options for people that have autism spectrum disorders? Is this, like, how does this sort of progress those treatment options?
Yeah, so great question. So there are no targeted therapies kind of for autism as a whole. So when I say targeted therapies, like genetic or specific, you know, circuit therapies that are known to be beneficial for autism, what we do know is there are behavioral therapies that work and they work quite well, but still they're effective for about 50% of the population, if you will. The problem is, if you look at these studies closely, you know, they require, you know, really rigorous, intensive behavioral therapy on the order of 20 to 40 hours a week with a really kind of clinically trained providers. And unfortunately, that is not available to most individuals with autism, you know, number one, because of the expense, and also because we just don't have enough trained providers. But importantly, it's still only about 50% effective, even at its best. And so we really need targeted therapies, because we, you know, this is a disorder that, again, is impacting 1 in 59 children in the United States at present. And so our hope is that if this or any other therapy can be developed, you know, kind of if you can identify circuits that are relevant to these behaviors, these being potentially one of them, if you can modulate these circuits and that modulation has improved circuit function and potentially then might improve behavior, you have a way potentially of, improving behavior and, you know, kind of the functioning of kids and potentially even adults with autism. And that would be definitely a strong benefit for, I think, for the field.
Well, we're just about out of time, Dr. Tsai. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today. I think it's really inspiring to see, you know, a research program that's dedicated to, like, looking at, you know, specific circuit mechanisms underlying certain behavioral abnormalities, and, like, actually having some kind of, you know, potential impact on, you know, this highly prevalent disease. It's not something you see very often in neuroscience. So congratulations on your great work, and we look forward to seeing what comes next.
All right. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
So that's our episode for today. We just want to thank our guest, Dr. Peter Tsai, for sharing a little bit more about what he's been doing, looking at the role of cerebellum in autism spectrum disorder. So it was kind of interesting learning about how our viewpoint of cerebellum has changed over the most recent history. We talked a little bit about how its role in motor function with Audrey. Audrey, are you surprised by the turn in perspective on cerebellum has taken?
Surprised, not really, because I've been working on the cerebellar circuit since quite a few years now. But I think this work is really amazing and exciting, and I'm really looking forward to see what's next.
Yeah, so I mean, the thing that really jumped out at me at the beginning was when one of his mentors or something had said that cerebellum was just a pillow for visual cortex. That was maybe the funniest thing I've ever heard.
A very useful pillow.
Yeah, a very useful pillow for visual cortex. Obviously it's so much more. I mean, for me, who's somebody who's not like a part of the cerebellum world, it's probably more shocking to hear like the direct links with like cognitive and affective aspects of our lives and things like that. Yeah, I know about it mostly from motor learning and the stuff that you do.
Yeah, and I'm really looking forward to sort of the progress that's being made in terms of translating some of these circuit findings to actual treatments for people that suffer from these disorders.
Yeah.
So we are out of time for today. Just want to thank you all for listening. You can find us on SoundCloud and iTunes and not iTunes, Apple Podcasts now.
Okay.
Google Play and our new website.
We're on Spotify now.
We're on Spotify as well. You can let us know what you think of the work Dr. Tsai is doing on Facebook, at Twitter, at Neuropodcast. And until next time.
Oh, wait, Audrey, you're on Twitter. What's your Audrey, Twitter handle?
I'm not.
You're not on Twitter?
Not
no.
on Twitter.
Okay, good for you.
I'm going to be soon.
Okay, stay tuned. Audrey will join Twitter. I'm at JW Science.
I am at JT Chang.
And we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you for listening to Neurotransmissions. You can find us on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, and now on Spotify. Connect with us on Twitter at Neuropodcast and at facebook.com/neuropodcast. This has been a production of the Max Planck Florida Institute for Neuroscience.